Hi there everybody, thank you for downloading this, the first in what will hopefully be an occasional series of podcasts from theoneliner.com. I'm site contributor Craig Eastman, and with me today are site designer and general overlord Scott Morris.
Hello.
And also site contributor Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
In this episode today, amongst other things, we will hopefully be giving you a rundown of the top 10 current UK general release films. So without further ado, let's get going. Okay, so it's time for the top 10 rundown of films currently on general release in the UK, and it's over to Scott.
Number 10, Death Sentence, which I haven't seen. I believe this is Kevin Bacon's attempting to protect his family from something from us all.
A sandwich.
From a sandwich.
Two slices of bread that's desperate for some bacon.
Just like bacon.
Now, when you say Kevin Bacon's family, do you mean Kevin Bacon's family or his on-screen family?
Well, I'm guessing it's his on-screen family, unless it's a very strange film.
Well, that's, we've cleared that up then.
So, perhaps essentially, we don't know anything about Death Sentence. Because of no interest whatsoever, unless you guys do.
I haven't seen it. I have heard about it. I have had it recommended to me by someone who likes films and is of a violent disposition. So I wouldn't necessarily take that as... I wouldn't necessarily take that as a go out and see it straight away. I think it's had some poor reviews. It's had some reasonable reviews.
So it's much like any other film.
Yes. Moving on then to number 9.
Number 9 is Bratz, the movie, which is of course exactly our target audience.
Yes, because I've got all of the dolls. I'm sure you do too.
I do. They're in a bit of a sad state now. They've been abused quite a lot.
I only have two.
You're disgusting.
I'm poor.
Leave now.
Okay. I think we can probably safely assume then that we don't have much to say on Bratz. I don't think anyone really who has seen the film will have much to say about Bratz. From what I can gather, it's shit. Would that be the general consensus? Not that we can have a consensus, we haven't seen it. But we're not open to pointless conjecture.
Much as we hate people who review films without seeing them, I've not seen it and reviewing it, it's awful.
Excellent. And number 8, Scott.
Okay, number 8, Transformers, in which Transformers come to Earth and stomp about as they tend to do.
As they tend to do. Now, this open to a bit of discussion here. I didn't particularly like the film. I thought it had virtually no redeeming features whatsoever, but I gather you two gentlemen liked it.
Very much so.
What was it you liked about it? I'm curious. I don't mean that in a condescending way.
Right, unquestionably has some of the best effects work you will ever see. If you want that from a sort of blockbuster,
that,
no,
that
no
much I grant
that.
You, but I didn't pay £6.85 to just see some pixels.
Right, you have that. Shia LaBeouf's great in it. It's very funny all the way through.
It's really quite witty. It's got a good sense of humour, but...
It's not witty.
Yes, it is.
In what way was it witty? Come on.
Yeah. It has a good sense of humour. It's...
It's fun. Yeah. One of the things
with childish.
It has some definite downsides, though. John Turturro's whole Secret Seven department, Famous Five, whatever it was called, something by Enid Blyton, I think.
Yeah.
Noddy.
Yes,
John Turturro's Noddy department.
I thought it had several downsides. I thought there were 140 downsides. They were called minutes. Didn't like it at all. I can't defend it at all. I can't agree with it at all in any of it, apart from the effects work. I don't know. I don't understand what anyone could find to like about it. I just thought it was pointless tosh, frankly.
No, it was fun.
Redeeming features.
It was typical cheesy blockbuster fare. It was disengage brain and enjoy.
But did you not
and
think...
And you did enjoy
but
it.
But I'm perfectly capable of disengaging my brain and enjoying a film. I just didn't think there was anything to enjoy. It was, what, 2 hours and 20 minutes long? Name three things that happened in it.
Transformers. They came to Earth and
they're just... Michael Bay has this policy of making films... But Bad Boys 2... I wish I could take back that 2.5 hours of my life, but I can't. I've gotten over that now. I can deal with it. But why does he take a film that will happily fit into, never mind 90 minutes, he could happily fit it into 80 minutes. It would have been a lot more comfortable fitting into 80 minutes, because then you would have had none of the dross in between the action scenes. And by action scenes... Well, I'm sorry.
No, I quite like them.
Yes, as did I.
Good and well executed.
Yeah.
Okay, there's the usual Michael Bay fault of wishing he would just keep his camera still for more than 2 seconds at a time.
But it's endemic in Hollywood nowadays.
Sometimes it worked. It lent a bit of kinetic energy to the action scenes and things like that. I can appreciate that. I didn't think his camera work was as offensive as some people were making out. I thought that was one of the lesser problems. I just thought it doesn't have a script. You've got big robots storming up to kids on bonus of cars saying, "Where is eBay item number 129?
Yes, which was quite funny. Yes. Obviously you don't like it, but we've established that you're wrong so far.
But it was, I laughed at it. I wasn't laughing at it because I thought it was funny. I was laughing at it because it was pathetic. Moving on to number 7 then. I don't think we're going to reconcile our differences on Transformers. So.
No, because you're wrong and won't admit it. Let us carry on.
Okay, so number 7, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, still hanging in there after Lord knows what, however many weeks. Is that 8 weeks now it's been there?
It'd be something like that.
Which I was hugely disappointed by, after the last two actually being fairly decent, certainly Goblet of Fire. I thought they'd actually cracked out to make a decent Harry Potter film, and this one is just terrible. It's far too short for, surprisingly, normally complain that films are far too long these days, but for something that the whole basis of it was Harry Potter struggling against a world where no one believes him anymore about Voldemort's return. They made it feel like it took over about 2 weeks and completely ruined any of the drama that's supposed to be there.
Yeah, absolutely no sense of time passing whatsoever, and no reason for why they would disbelieve him.
Exactly, I mean, the whole thing has been ludicrously overblown from the start. It was a silly book when you read it. It was quite a silly film. It doesn't make any sense that people just buried their heads in the sand about it.
Yeah.
Well, there's a threat coming. Let's not even bother investigating it. It just doesn't make any sense.
For those that don't know, I'm shorn of all Harry Potter knowledge. I've never paid any attention to it at all. I can't really be doing with it. I haven't read any of the books, haven't seen the films. From what I can gather, is this not both the longest of the books, yet also the shortest of the films?
I believe that's the case. It's certainly the shortest of the films.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure whether It or Goblet of Fire is longer. There might only be a few pages difference between them, but it's certainly one of the longest out of the 7.
And so what, the Harry Potter fan who's listening now, the one Harry Potter fan who might not have seen the film yet, what key instances then are there of some, what isn't in the film that you feel is critically missing from?
It's not so much what isn't in the film as, it does everything that is needed to go on and do the rest of the books without really missing any major incidents, as far as I can recall. What it doesn't do is, the whole point of this is, basically it's a year of Harry being disbelieved, marginalised, and being treated as an outcast.
Persecuted, by
the government. And
the press.
Yeah, so the whole point of it is, Harry Potter has a staunch determination to what he believes is the truth. But because you're feeling that over about the course of 2 weeks rather than a year, you don't get the same sense of impact of it. That's basically what's missing from it.
Yeah, and it's also missing largely the emotional section of the end of the book. It's the only real part where there's any sort of real emotion in the characters, other than, oh, I feel happy, I feel sad. But the grief that the main character feels.
Mm.
And it's just given ridiculously short shrift in the film. Mm. Like, this tragedy has happened, I am sad. Why has this happened? Here, film ends.
Was there enough occupying the rest of the film, though? Is it a case of there was still a lot of dead space in the film that could have been better spent on these issues you're talking about then?
Well, it wasn't long enough to have dead space.
Or was it one of these films that actually could have done for once with an extra half an hour in the runtime?
And you have to remember that the first film was, 2.5 hours, Philosopher's Stone?
That did nothing.
Yeah, 2.5 hours for easily the shortest book, right? Which is probably about a quarter of the length of Order of the Phoenix, certainly a third. And nothing happens, partly it's due to Chris Columbus being such a hack of a director, but nothing happens.
I should imagine a lot of character establishment and whatnot, though.
Although, really.
I can't imagine much of an audience for the film for the people who haven't read the books, anyway.
The character establishment is basically their kids who are at school. That's all it really was. There's not an awful lot of it in the first one.
But yes, that's an hour longer than Order of the Phoenix, and nothing happens. Whereas Order of the Phoenix, a lot of stuff happens that, to carry on the story for the next two films, really needed to be in there. And they'd already made a mistake in Goblet of Fire, that there was some stuff that probably should have been in there, but wasn't, that I'll not talk about now. It's just a few changed plot points in the book that made me wonder, watching it, how they were going to get onto that. It just means that because they've missed out some things, they're going to have to change the rest of the films even more substantially than the books, which alienates the target audience.
Am I correct in saying also that I've heard there's a scene in this film where a character who is, fairly major to events later on, is actually a major character dies and barely,
it's very badly
very
explained.
That's the tragedy I was talking about at the end. Right. There's just the response to it is inappropriate.
Gotcha.
It's not bad enough.
So not necessarily particularly well weighted then?
No. Plus, the effects work has gone back downhill as well. I have no idea what they were doing with a lot of that. There's a big fight at the end, which looks entirely different to every other fight that's been in all the rest of the films.
And there's been no mention of it in the books, largely what happened is everybody turns into a sand monster.
And flies about willy-nilly.
There's a trip to the Ministry of Magic building, where the climactic fight happens in the book, and so the film follows that along. But in the book, it's a book about wizards and magic, so largely they use lots of different types of magic at each other.
Yes.
Which, unfortunately, in the books, largely involves coloured light. Every spell is some coloured light, so they followed that in the earlier films.
It all sounds very Final Fantasy.
Yes, but in the showdown of Order of the Phoenix, the film, everybody just turns into a sand monster.
Who are we to judge them?
And it's just... So you're just watching, it's just, that's some particle effects on the computer. I've got no emotion in this at all.
As intrigued as I can be by a Harry Potter film, I'm quite interested by this one because it seems to have split opinions. A lot of people are saying this is the best of the films so far. No. Whereas there's another just as sizable camp to say, well, no, actually, I think, is it Prisoner of Azkaban is still...
Definitely, it's the one that's put into film language the best.
The one that you have recommended that if I do actually ever watch one, I should probably make it that one.
You would appreciate the stylings of it. It is a proper film, whereas a lot of the rest of them just feel like books that have been squeezed onto a film canvas.
Fair enough.
The best translation that I've seen. Much as I was disappointed by Order of the Phoenix, it's not actually terrible, and it's perfectly watchable. You can sit in front of it and watch it quite happily and not being too bored by it. So in that sense, it works. But compared to what it should have been...
As entertainment, it works. But if emotionally, it's lightweight. Incredibly lightweight.
So not perhaps the level of emotional involvement you would expect from something at this stage in the franchise then?
Yeah, especially when a lot of the focus of the book is about the emotions that Harry Potter's experience, as you'd expect, from
presumably
not being believed
being outcast,
and having had such a difficult life and continuously pain, persecution and then grief, you'd expect that you try and get that through. And it's not even Daniel Radcliffe's fault nowadays, because if every film he gets better, and he still struggles sometimes with some of the emotion and expression, but he's getting a lot better, isn't he?
He is better. The main characters are getting better. It's odd that they've marginalised Alan Rickman so much, given that he's going to be
very,
very
important
going on
in the next two films.
And he has, two scenes?
If that.
Or something? Two lines, which is very strange, but...
They also seem to...
presumably just pop it in to pick up his cheque and off home.
The casting's not quite as good either. In the first couple of films, they had the adult casting spot on, and it was the children's casting that was wrong, because Daniel Radcliffe, especially in the first two films, was notoriously awful. but he's improved, and good on him.
Speaking of the adult cast in this film, someone in particular I understand has been drawing plaudits for her performance as a wicked teacher.
Imelda Staunton.
Well, the other one.
I'm not convinced on her.
There's no plus, she did it well enough, but...
I've got to be honest with you, I'm just not a huge fan of Imelda Staunton's acting style in the first place. I know a lot of people have been saying what a fantastic performance she gives in this, and it's her film, but that's not necessarily... Saying it's her film is not necessarily going to get me to get up off my backside.
Unfortunately,
and
ever since I first read Order of the Phoenix, the character that Imelda Staunton plays, Dolores Umbridge, I've always... Because
you're
describing...
You had quite a firm image in your head of what she should be like.
Well, yes, because she's supposed to be toad-like, and so she's always, always looked like Ross from Monsters, Inc., which creates a bit of a problem for the casting in a live action
film.
And
then she pops up and she looks a lot like Vera Drake, god damn her. So safe to say then, probably, I'm sure the fans will lap it up, but not necessarily the best installment in the franchise.
It certainly wouldn't be a good starting point.
And I wouldn't say they would lap it up, actually, because I can imagine they'd be quite disappointed, especially since I've mentioned it a couple of times, but at the end when Harry finds out the truth about why his parents were killed, you would imagine for any character in any film, regardless of whether it's Harry Potter and had a book first or what, that would be an important thing, an emotional impact. It's covered in about three lines, and Harry takes it largely, "Oh, right then, I'll walk away now, shall I?"
Well, we all deal with these things differently.
There's no emotional impact at all, no sense of grief.
Fair enough. What's it?
Of course, I locked away because I didn't want the police to catch me when they found out my parents were dead, but that's a different topic.
Well, you've just got a blab now, haven't you? What's it, number six, Scott?
Number six, no reservations, which, again, one I've dodged so far, but apparently...
One which we so far have made no reservations for ourselves.
A master chef, not master chief, that's the Halo film that's gone up. Captain Zeta Jones lives her life like she runs her kitchen at an upscale restaurant, yada, 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 and then apparently Aaron Eckhart comes in and they fall in love. Oh, well.
Does it have Lloyd Grossman in it saying they're going to digest, cogitate and discuss?
Let me
because
just
that was important to MasterChef, as I recall.
Doesn't, but it does have a truffle dealer.
A truffle dealer?
Yes, played by Yevgeny Dekhtar, or something along those lines. And Fish Vendor Bob, who's always one of my favourite characters anything he appears in a film.
These damn truffle dealers. So not one we've seen, then we can't really comment on it unfairly, but I'll certainly step up and say it's got Catherine Zeta-Jones in it.
It can't be any good.
It can fuck off. What's at number five, Scott?
At number five, we have Rush Hour 3. Again, there's a slight bar. Yeah, I can't defend it all that much, but I thought it was okay.
It was alright. But it's not as good as Rush Hour 2.
Yeah, no. The action sequences were fine, getting a bit tenuous towards the end. It was still funny enough. I didn't feel cheated out of the £5 that I would have paid to put up.
I feel Chris Tucker is he's a bit unfairly treated by a lot of people I've heard speaking about, a lot of reviews I've read about the film. Chris Tucker seems to take a lot of slack. People saying, I can't stand Chris Tucker. I thought Chris Tucker was extremely funny in the previous two Rush Hour films.
Yeah, and the Fifth Element. I always like Chris Tucker.
It's not like he's overexposed or anything.
He's accused of being very whiny. And
he's not Jim Carrey.
That's what makes him... I'm not a huge fan of that kind of comedy, but I've always thought Chris Tucker was quite affable in the way he goes about it. He's not offensive. His performances in these films, he's never afraid to poke a bit of fun at himself.
Yeah.
I just thought with Rush Hour 3, I just thought it was so hackneyed and so jaded. I felt really let down by it. I think your review, Scott, you gave it 3 stars, didn't you?
Yeah.
I would have thought myself, if I'd given it 3 stars, I was being generous. I would have plumped for 2. Not that big of a difference. But I was just really disappointed. But I think that's probably because I enjoyed Rush Hour 2 so much.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it fine enough. I have no real complaints about it. It kept me amused all the way throughout it. The taxi driver, whose name I've forgotten off the top of my head, but he's very funny.
A comedy sidekick that wasn't actually irritating, which is always a nice change.
And again, with the odds stacked against him in being French. Zut alors. I didn't think the stunt work was particularly... I don't think there was anything to shout about in any of the fight scenes or any of the stunt work, to be honest with you, either.
I suppose we could mention the plot, but there's not really one.
A certain actor turns up, and you see who the actor is, and you realise, I know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, he'll be the bad guy then.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
Because it's him.
The one good thing, that's incredibly shallow of me to say so, I thought, what an attractive lady, even if she has no hair.
Yes, I thought of that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, what's at number 4, Scott? Have we done number 5?
We've got to say, number 5, Rush Hour 3. I really hope they don't do a Rush Hour 4.
No, yes, I don't think they will.
They've pretty much run out of steam with the franchise.
It's entertaining enough, but it doesn't.
Unless Jackie Chan can learn to do some few stunts in a wheelchair, I don't imagine we'll be seeing it anytime soon.
If they try to make another one, it will become a Police Academy film.
That would be punishment enough in itself. What's at number 4, Scott?
Number 4, The Simpsons Movie.
Ah.
Which, again, 6 weeks, still going strong, making money hand over fist.
And again, must have cost threepence halfpenny to make.
Yes.
Well, in the grand scheme of things, I don't imagine it cost as much as your average summer blockbuster, and yet it's very much ruled the roost until a certain Mr. Jason Bourne popped back into the fold this summer, didn't it?
True, indeed. Homer Simpson accidentally ruins the local environment and places shut off by a large dome. They escape. They go back in. It's basically a slightly beefed up standard episode of The Simpsons from kind of
That's the thing everybody says at the moment. It's like the one criticism they can find to it, and I think it's picking
a lot of fault with it.
Yeah, that's it. It's like we need to pick one fault with it because it's not as spectacular or as groundbreaking as we were hoping. It's really just one or two episodes stretched out to feature length. But as if that's a bad thing.
It's more Simpsons is never bad.
Exactly.
I wouldn't say it's been nitpicking, and I agree that it's like a few episodes stitched together, it's how it feels. It's just not as funny as we've been expecting. Because it was a film, I thought, it was very, very funny. It was as funny as any normal Simpsons episode.
It was as funny as the funniest episode I've seen.
But that's what I was thinking. What? I was expecting to be in tears and have a sore side for the entire film because it's the Simpsons in a film. I was expecting more. It doesn't mean it was bad.
There are occasional genius moments there, but they're not the kind of, it's not sustained genius. It's the odd moment, obviously, with it's not given much away to say that we see Bart's doodle, as I think he refers to it in the film, after a particularly well-staged Austin Powers type objects in the way of genitals scene, but there were odd flashes like that, but it wasn't anything that contributed anything to character. Or, and oddly enough, I felt something as had it been in the TV series, something as substantial as Lisa gets a boyfriend, it wasn't actually played on all that much.
No,
correct me if I'm wrong, I felt they sort of missed a trick with that. That's quite a major plot development, I would have thought. That's a lot up there with Maggie's first words, isn't it?
Yeah, which Maggie did. Although they seem to have forgotten that Maggie had her first words already, because in the credits, Maggie's going to say her first word. Sequel.
But no, I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing just to have the Simpsons.
It's interesting that I've seen it a couple of times now, and it does seem to stand up to repeat watches quite well.
Yeah, it does.
In the same way that
I
probably would have laughed a lot more in the cinema when I saw Zoolander or something like that, which would have been stitches all the way throughout. But when you then take Zoolander home and watch it, it's never.
You're sitting yourself with a microwave curry on your own sofa. You sort of think no one else is around. You're thinking to yourself,
it's still funny, but you're never in stitches again. Whereas Simpsons movie, everything I've seen it, I've laughed at the same bits as hard as I did all the times before.
Absolutely,
seems to have a lot better length.
If you don't like the Simpsons, you're still not going to like the Simpsons. But if you like the Simpsons, you'll love it.
It's not going to pay any converse. Exactly. Yeah. But if you're a fan of the TV series, all right, it wasn't groundbreaking, but that's not an excuse to pick on it, because at the same time it didn't really put a foot wrong either.
Exactly.
Yes, and also if you already don't like The Simpsons, don't find them funny. They're not really interested in speaking to you.
I can add another point as well, though. I see that a lot of emphasis has been put on Spider Pig. I didn't think that was all that funny.
I did, actually.
I didn't think it was funny as...
I've been humming that tune for weeks.
I didn't think it was as funny as the continual flogging of the Huskies. Including rest, rest. Oh goodness, what's at number three, Scott?
Number three is 1408, sadly, which I guess everyone else has.
Wait a
dodged.
Minute, number 1408 can't be number three.
Well, they did some reordering. There was a bit of a swap.
Number three is old and busted.
He's lost his place quite so much, which sadly I have seen.
And what did you think?
It's right. What happens is you've got
First of all, it's a Stephen King novella.
Exactly,
that it's based on, isn't it?
Right, you have John Cusack as a paranormal investigator who goes around scary hotels, sleeping in them, and writing poor books about them, like the 10 scariest hotels in America and things like that. He goes into a particularly haunted one. He goes into room 1408, which is where the title comes from, obviously. After suitably dire warnings from Sam Jackson. This is usual.
Don't go in that room, motherfucker!
Essentially, yes. There's probably snakes.
Possibly. I need to get all these motherfucking ghosts out of the motherfucking hotel.
So he goes into it, and various silly things happen to him, and he descends into a world of hellish nightmare and things. Now,
he has to watch the film too.
It's very much a reflection of his career then.
Pretty much. He was on the news the other day saying...
What has happened to John Cusack?
He says he's only done 10 good films in his life, and he's quite sanguine about the fact that most of the films he's done have sucked, which is very brave of him.
The thing is that puzzles me about John Cusack is that he was at that point in his career where he was doing very well, and then he managed to... He had the sleeper hit of the summer with Gross Point Blank, and actually since he made that absolutely excellent film, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Identity. I don't understand what's happened. It's gone downhill very quickly for him.
Yes, he's done a lot of rubbish. There's the odd moment in between them. I mean, he's done things like he was in Being John Malkovich.
High Fidelity.
He's Max, which was interesting, if nothing else. But then you get to things like Runaway Jury and Must Love Dogs and Vice Harvest, and they're all pretty bland.
Must Love Dogs looked like it's been awful. It was bland, it was all right, but still, it's not the sort of standard.
He's tried in a hell of a lot of water for a man with such an obvious talent as himself.
And again, even Max, well, it was an interesting film. The most interesting part was Noah Taylor's character was Hitler.
Actually, was it when he appeared in Con Air that it all started to go a bit odd for him? They started to wibble wobble a bit.
Connie was the same year as Gross Point Blank, so I'm not sure.
I assume that was...
Yeah, it was the one right after.
I assume it was one of those deals where he was probably told, right, if you want to make Gross Point Blank on your terms with all this jazz, as a director you want and whatnot, you'll be in the Conair.
But 1408, it's a horror film, and as such you judge it with a lot of horror films. It's probably a bit better than most of the rest of the horror films you've seen over the last year. Mainly because it's basically John Cusack going a bit crazy. John Cusack, for all his faults, is still a very good actor. Mm. If you'd put, I don't know, Ashton Kutcher in that role or something, the film would be absolutely dire. You know, everyone's seen The Butterfly Effect. Well, no, he's not an actor. Because John Cusack's there...
I'm not sure he's a human.
Yeah, that's a point. without the droid like him in it. It's not awful, is about as good as I'll say to it. If you must watch a horror film... It's as good a choice as I've seen this year.
Well, given the current crop of horror films, that's not, you know...
All the good horror films that I've seen last year have been remakes of old horror films, where they've tried to deviate as little as possible from the script of the last one.
Yeah.
So, for
conversely, all the worst ones we've seen in the last year have also all been remakes.
That's true.
Yes, but that's
in fact, just all horror films this year have been remakes.
Because most films nowadays are remakes, or television
exactly.
programmes.
Exactly. Oh, when will they get round to Captain Pugwash?
After Nog and the Nog. It's on the way.
Marin Burek stands again.
That would be a difficult casting call.
Peter Kay's going to do it, so I don't think I'll watch it.
Paul Giamatti.
That's your answer to everything, though, isn't it? Who will play Margaret Thatcher? Paul Giamatti.
What's it number three, Scott?
1408, which we've just covered.
Yes,
Wicked.
Up.
What's it number two, Scott?
At number two, we have Knocked Up, which is very funny. I have no issue with that at all.
I've only seen the first half hour of it, criminally.
2 weeks on the chart and made a lot of money. It's been a tremendous success.
Manages to do what in other films might be clawing and horribly sentimental, actually quite sweet at the end, and you don't feel like you've been doused in sugar syrup.
Yeah, there's no. It's not too manipulative, but it's very funny all the way throughout. It doesn't feel forced to particularly at any point, and it seems fairly realistic.
As you'd expect from the man who brought us a 40-year-old virgin and was involved in Anchorman.
Absolutely. It's been quite a summer for Judd Apatow. Is it Apatow or...
Apatow.
Judd Apatow. This summer in the States, because he has... We also have coming up soon Superbad, don't we? And he's scored a massive double with those in...
Yeah, just recently the name of the character. It's Seth Rogen who plays the lead, Ben Stone, who is about as realistic a character as I've ever seen in a film. He just seems like a normal guy. You could quite believe this guy just walked off the street and started playing himself in a film.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's not an awful lot of that you see these days.
He was briefly in 40-Year-Old Virgin, wasn't he?
Yeah,
he's the video game playing sort of...
Yeah.
Yeah. The two couch potatoes.
Yeah. He gets down with Elizabeth Banks when Steve Carell...
That's right.
Bolts.
That's fair enough. And what's at number one then, Scott? As if we need ask.
The Bourne Ultimatum, where Jason Bourne returns to find out more about his past, which has been going on dragging on a bit now, so I suppose it's about time he found out what was going on with that. I forget the exact details. Fill me in.
Drew?
it picks up about half an hour before the end of the Bourne Supremacy, with Jason Bourne in Moscow having been shot and survived this chase through the Moscow subway in the incredible, indestructible Russian taxi.
Absolutely.
Patented.
By Karl Urban, no less, I believe.
Yes.
Karl Urban's not going to lie to you.
Exactly.
Karl Urban loved it.
It then follows his flight away from the authorities, who are determined to kill him. And I can't remember anything more.
That's fair enough.
You can carry on.
Well, it's basically Matt Damon running about for an hour, as with the rest of them, isn't it?
Here's my problem with it. It's incredibly slick, and I did give it 4 stars in my review. You won't see a more efficient thriller anywhere this year so far, I don't think.
Most years,
to be honest with you, it's as slick as it comes, and it's easy to pick on the dodgy camera work. I'm not even going to go into that because, it was a bit annoying. It's a bit over the top, the old loose on the ball documentary.
Although not quite as bad as the Bourne Supremacy, but still enough to be irritating.
Well, now, here's the thing. That's the problem with it. It's not only lifted that from the Bourne Supremacy. Most people I've heard or who I've read reviews of this film from seem to. They must have incredibly short memories, because the main problem I have with it is that whole sections of it, and I'm not just talking about the sections where intentionally it's overlapped with the Bourne Supremacy, huge sections of it have literally been copied and pasted. The final car chase ends.
Yes.
The last 2 minutes of it, it ends exactly
when
the same.
Bourne's in the police car.
Yeah,
yeah,
it ends exactly
very
the same as in the Bourne Supremacy, down to the point where he crashes his car. The guy who's in the other car is slumped behind the wheel, injured, whether or not it's fatally or not. Bourne points his gun at him, contemplates shooting him, doesn't shoot him. Is exactly the same as Carl Urban's fate in, at the end of the Bourne Supremacy. That and a lot of other things as well. And I just think that and it seemed to it's got a very cut and paste formula now. You know, there's a brilliant chase at the start in which station is it in London? Was it Waterloo Station?
That was a very enjoyable scene, especially because it's Jason Bourne showing supreme craft.
Yeah,
his
exactly.
Spy craft. And it's very, very entertaining.
How do you make someone trying to get out of a crowded train station exciting? Well, I'll tell you how you do it. You ask Paul Greengrass, and fair enough, I don't subscribe to this current notion that Paul Greengrass is the most amazing director in the world.
Well, no, because we've seen United 93.
We've seen United 93, and you guys agreed with me on that one, I think. I wasn't that impressed by it.
It was incredibly tedious.
Yeah. But he certainly does a bloody good job of everything that's on hand here. It's just that it is all very derivative. And
yeah, but he did also do this Bourne Supremacy though, so he just
he's just copying his own work. But you have this formula now. I mean, I've no doubt you'll probably get another Bourne film at some point, but maybe not for a few years yet. But I'm pretty sure it'll happen.
I believe Matt Damon was talking about the Bourne redundancy.
That would make sense. You know,
probably possibly the Bourne speedboat.
That's it. Apart from the that's probably the best reel of the film, actually, is the opening reel, because it's quite inventive, it's quite fresh. I haven't seen that before, or at least that well done ever. That sort of a chase. There's no gunfight going on. You know, it's just someone getting someone else out of a train station. It's very clever. Yeah. It's very cosmically paced, but then you have to have the cookie cutter, the scene now where he has a fight with one of the assets, as they're called, one of the other agents, where he improvises with a household object. In the first film you had a biro pen, in the second film you had a rolled up magazine, this time round you have a hardback book. Yeah, that fight's over and done with, and then there's a bit of a chase, and then there's a car chase at the end, and then I'm not entirely sure why it's been billed as a revelation, because he doesn't actually learn anything more in this film than he did in the first one, apart from where it was that he was brainwashed.
There's a bit more of a flashback going on this time.
Yeah, there's a little bit more flashback going on, but apart from that, you learned everything you need to know about his past in the last one.
Yes, but again,
this just clears up, which room his brainwashing was carried out in effectively. Correct me if I'm wrong, it's not a great revelation, but fortunately, the ride...
Yeah,
getting there is well worth the price of entry, and I don't think I've probably seen a film which it's not Citizen Kane, but I don't think I've been to the cinema and had better value for money this year.
True, it's odd that you're accusing it of being formulaic when they've been stridently putting Bond down over the past couple of weeks, the makers of it, for they were being the most formulaic franchise.
Yeah, exactly, which clearly it aspires to.
Oh, I've very much enjoyed it. I can't think of anything that I would have changed in it. It's very good all the way throughout.
Other than the camera work.
It's as good as something like that can be done.
Yeah, it's not even just that problem with the Bourne Ultimatum though, so you can't really criticise it individually about the camera work.
It's like Shrek.
So we're complaining about Transformers too.
Yeah.
Keep the camera still, give us a wide shot. We promise our attention will not wane.
I can almost let away with some of the things like that, but when it does the fight scenes and it's doing shaky cam, it's like we used to do that with Jet Li films as well, certainly all the Western ones, where they just like them cuts every second and make the cameras go away. So give us a long shot of him just doing his stuff. He's quite good enough at it to entertain me by himself. You don't need to try and...
But I tell you one thing, and it was highlighted in, and nobody... Well, we talk about it often enough on the website, but very few other people do, and in that fight scene in particular... it was mentioned to me, the sound editing was absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
And in a scene where actually there's no music or there's no other incidental sound or anything, it's just two guys fighting, they're not shouting at each other, it's just the slapping and the grunting, and you know,
they realise they don't have the breath for shouting.
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
They realise that
because it's so efficient. Exactly, it was phenomenally, the sound editing in the film as a whole is absolutely excellent, I thought.
Yeah, it's been a bit... The whole area has been underrepresented for a long time. It's so important to films, and no one ever talks about it.
Who was it? Whose quote is it that sound is 70% of a film?
Yes.
I can't remember. I may well just have made that up, in which case I claim
it's
it.
It's your quote, yes.
But yeah, exactly. But no, I'm pretty sure there is a quote from someone relatively famous at some point who said sound is 70% of a film. And to be honest with you, I agree. And what's at number zero, Scott?
Number zero's not listed. Not yet. Other things that are on release that may have been seen. Breach is out, which I think we're interested to hear, but I've only seen about an hour of it myself. It seems It's Chris Cooper as he's suspected of leaking information to the Russians, and I've watched about an hour of that. It's very dry.
To be fair, you didn't watch it on a plane.
That's true. I possibly just was not in the mood for it at the time.
I'm sure you weren't getting the full cinematic.
It's not a particularly cinematic piece.
No, it's not.
It's basically based in an office.
It's a talky piece.
Yeah. I don't know. It has been well regarded enough that I will give that one a second try.
I haven't seen a single frame of it, and I like it. That's my review.
Oh, I'm certainly quite interested just because of the cast it's got.
Yeah, absolutely. I know I'm going to like it before
cast.
I even see it, yeah.
Because I'm interested in seeing it.
That's the kind of film I like, the sort of procedural kind of, you know, extremely long, very procedural.
I don't know.
For some reason I find that sort of thing very appealing.
It can be, but then it could be The Good Shepherd.
Well, no,
which
see,
wasn't
that's
bad,
the point I was going
very,
to make as
well,
as I really enjoyed The Good Shepherd. I can appreciate why most people probably didn't enjoy it, but it just appealed to me personally. I like that kind of thing. I don't mind spending a bit of time just watching people doing nothing, essentially.
No, I can take slow burning in westerns. It seems to fit some other genres, though. It just doesn't work for me.
Mm. But then, what better genre than a spy? There you go.
I prefer it for spy myself. It's lovely.
Good show.
The actual title, Spy Folk, for me.
It's not a spy film, but I would mention Day of the Jackal.
I'd love Day of the Jackal. I love the methodical nature of his planning. It's
absolutely
very, very cool. And the rather refreshing, manner too, that the police don't rely on any ridiculous skill or incredible bits of luck. It's just
or
hard
someone
work.
That's sitting at a keyboard going enhanced.
It's just hard work. The man's intelligent. He knows the sort of places he should be looking. They use their hard work, and they eventually.
Absolutely.
It's very satisfying.
It's as much a police procedural drama as it is an assassination thriller. Or failed assassination thriller.
Yes.
It's not giving too much away to say. And we're not talking about The Jackal with Bruce Willis and Richard Gere, people.
I'll thank you not to mention that again.
Exactly.
Or The Mustaches.
What else is on general release, Scott?
Well, the only other interesting thing I see in the top 15 would be Harlem 4, the latest UK indie hope from. Released by Disney, apparently.
Which I haven't seen, but I've certainly heard enough about. Elaborate for those who may be interested.
You have your Billy Elliot star going through his.
What's his name?
Jamie Bell. In what?
There's something wrong with this place.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. From all the PR I've seen, it seems to be positioned as Billy Elliot's first role after Billy Elliot, apart from the other eight films he's been in
since then,
including the one major role in Death Watch.
Yes, and it's not like he's just been a small film, as though King Kong made quite a lot of money.
Yeah. Possibly you could argue, okay, it's his first lead performance since then, fair enough, might let him away with that, but they seem to be gloss over that and just say it's the first time you've seen him since then, and obviously it's not. He is a very damaged.
If it's the first time you realise you've seen him since
then. He plays a damaged kid, Alan Foe, who is still recovering from the death of his mother, and who's obviously taken it quite hard. He spends most of his time in a treehouse with a huge blown up poster of his mother to look over him, and generally he's a bit damaged. After his dad remarries, I can't remember exactly remarried or it's just
I think he's intending remarrying, I'm not sure he'd actually done it yet.
Yeah, to his former secretary, he gets a little bit upset, winds up sleeping with her, and then runs away to Edinburgh, whereupon he finds someone that looks a little bit like his mother, follows her.
Almost like it's the same actress who's in the passport photograph.
Who'd have thought?
Uncanny how they do those things.
It's a fortunate coincidence, isn't it?
Yes, it's very, very happy coincidence for the filmmakers, I think.
Ah, the magic of films!
He follows her around to his place of work, blags his way in to work as a kitchen staff in the hotel that she works in, and basically stalks her.
As you do.
Finds a convenient place to run a little peeping Tom operation into her back window. It's frankly a bit creepy. It's almost like presented as a kind of a knockabout romantic comedy, despite being about stalking.
It's about a very, very disturbed young boy who gets better, and he is disturbed.
Well, not a lot better. He's still wearing a badger hat, isn't he?
Yes.
You'll appreciate this. You remember? You can't really forget Devil's Gate.
No, I can't. I wish I could.
The fellow that would rumble about in the rafters with the kind of sheepskin headdress.
Yes.
He kind of channels
the most sensible character in the film.
The one who goes, me, me,
me. Beaker.
Yeah, so
down from the ceiling, Beaker.
He doesn't get a lot better. He's still quite damaged at the end of it. I seem to be asked to find quite a lot of sympathy for a guy who's quite sick and needs immediate professional help.
Fair enough.
I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to take home message was, apart from, you know, sometimes you can stop people and it's all right.
Sorry, as long as it's done responsibly.
Yes, if you don't really mean it, it's all right. I'm not sure what the point was. For something that's hailed as the big indie hit of the summer, it's not very good, and I was quite bored by a lot of it, to be honest with you.
And that's what I said to you after we'd seen it too. There were bits, and I thought that's some quite impressive acting. That's enjoyable, but the rest of it's just kind of weird and dull.
A lot of roof running and stuff in it, isn't there as well? Does he not follow about from rooftop to rooftop or something like
there's
that?
There's not so much running, they're sort of walking carefully because it's a roof. You can't really do much
it's
running
a roof
on a roof.
It's Edinburgh, yes.
I wasn't particularly engaged by it on any level. I didn't feel sorry for the guy, I didn't feel like I could hope that he was getting better, I didn't give a damn about him.
Although, having said that, given how creepy his character is, I think Jamie Bell does rather a good job because he's creepy, but you don't hate him.
That's true.
You don't want something bad to happen to him or somebody to beat him up because he's spying on these people. There's an element of sympathy to it. You certainly don't hate him, so he's doing something right, I suspect.
Also features a welcome return for Ewan Bremner.
Ewan Bremner, yes.
Ewan Bremner.
You just don't see enough of him in films these days, and especially in his full broad accent that he plays here.
As opposed to the strange Irish accent he's using Welcome to the Jungle, or whatever accent he's using
down.
Alien versus Predator.
Oh my goodness.
And again, it's also good to see Jamie Sykes, if they look up the name there, but our favourite film from Wilbur.
Yes. Doesn't say Snow Beast though, which disappointed me personally very much.
Fair enough.
If you haven't seen Wilbur, you probably haven't, you really should. It is one of the best films
I've seen. I seem to remember thinking it was excellent. And that's a rundown of the top 10 and what's on general release at the moment. Well, thanks for taking the time to listen to our first podcast from theoneliner.com. Remember, any correspondence you have, any feedback on the podcast can be sent to podcast@theoneliner.com. We look forward to hearing from you, and we also look forward to speaking to you at some juncture in the near future. Thanks again.